Parsha Balo Sechar contains within it actually many themes. It begins, of course, with Balo Sechar Saneros, with the menorah. And this is not the first time the menorah has been mentioned in the Torah. It's actually the third. It's mentioned in Chumash Shemos, Parsha Tetzaveh, Chumash Vayikra, Parsha Emor, and here again in Chumash Bamidbar. But, as Rashi points out, sourced in the Medrash, there is something happened here that is the cause for the third mentioning, or brings it into the beginning of the Parsha. On the word Baha'losecha, Rashi comments, Lama nismecha Parshas HaMenorah leParshas HaNasiyim? Why is it that the Parsha of the Menorah is juxtaposed and follows on immediately after the Parsha of the Nesiyim? Mefarshei Rashi explain, Rashi will always discuss Smichas Parshas and raise the question as to why something follows on when intuitively it should not have followed on. The lighting of the menorah is part of the regular avoda of the Mishkan and has been active since day one. Day one is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The 12 days of the Nisan were the first 12 days of Nisan. The message of the mitzvah of the lighting of the menorah was not given to Aaron after day 12, and he already knew it on day one. And that's really at least part of what's behind Rashi's question. Lama nismecha, it seems slightly out of place, following on from the Nisiyim. It's later than Aaron needs to know it, and later than indeed he knew it. So lama nismecha parshas ha-menorah leparshas ha-Nisiyim. Rashi explains, lefisha keshera Aaron chanukas ha-Nisiyim. When Aaron saw all of the Nisiyim, they're bringing their korbanos, cholsha az dato, he became despondent. He wasn't involved with them. Lohu velo shivto. Not only Aaron the person, not only Aaron the Kohen, but Aaron the Levi. There's no representation of Shevet Levi in the Chanukah Mishkan. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Hashem says to Aaron to comfort him, to encourage him. Chayecha, by your life. Shelcha gedola mishelahem. Your portion will be greater than theirs. Shatamadlik umeitiv es haneiros, for you are involved in the menorah in hadlokas haner ba'losecha es haneiros. And therefore, in brief, what Rashi is saying is, what is the parsha of the menorah doing again after the section of the Nesiyim? This is the nechama for Aaron. He wasn't involved by the Nesiyim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu reassured him, consoled him, that he has this greater measure through Hadlokas Haneiros. And of course, Mefarshim ask, beginning with Ramban, what is so unique about the menorah? It's true, it's something that Aaron does, representing the Kohanim. It's one of a number of avodos that Aaron does, and only Aaron can do. There's the Ketores, and there's the Menachos, and there's the Korban Tomid. I mean, the whole enterprise called Avodas HaMishkan essentially rests only with Aaron representing the Kohanim, and by extension, Shevet Levi. So of all of the aspects of Avodas HaMishkan, why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses and singles out the menorah as the comfort for Aaron? How is the menorah meant to make him feel better? And the Rachaim HaKadosh begins the answer by noting that actually what was bothering Aaron, as Rashi himself says, Cholsha Azdato, he was despondent, Shelo Hoya Imahim Bechanukah. He wasn't in the dedication, he wasn't in the inauguration, Lohu Veloshivto. As if to say, as important and indeed indispensable and critical as the ongoing avoda of the Mishkan, and that can only be done by Aaron, nonetheless, there's something about the Chanukah, there's something about getting it going, start launching the Mishkan. And Aaron, with all of the regular avoda that he has, nonetheless felt despondent that he wasn't part of the Chanukah, of the initiation. Well, if that's the problem, then what's the solution? After all, if what's bothering him is he's not part of the special Chanukah inauguration, how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu comfort him with the mitzvah of the menorah, which, as we just mentioned, is one of the many ongoing avodos? If his problem is he wasn't there to start it off, how will anything ongoing help him? And the Ruach Chaim gives his explanation. I'd like to slightly divert and take us to a comment of the Baalei HaTosfos. We have collections of commentaries on the Torah from the Baalei HaTosfos. They didn't just comment on the Gemara. Das is a Kenim, is a classic collection. And in Parshas Truma, the Tosfos raise an interesting shaila. In the beginning of Parshas Truma, the Torah lists all of the materials for the Mishkan. As we know, Zahav, Techeleh, Zahav, Kesef, Zahav, Nechoshes, Techeleh, Vagaman, the whole thing, Atzei Shittim, etc. These are all the things that are needed for the Mishkan. Then, the Pasuk goes on to mention Shemen Lama'or. Shemen Lama'or. Oil for lighting. Also important. It's for the lighting of the menorah. Asked the Tosfos, this ingredient seems to be out of place for the beginning of Truma. Because the beginning of Truma is about collecting all the materials for the construction of the Mishkan. Shemen Lama'or is one of the mitzvahs that is involved in the operation of the Mishkan. But that's once the Mishkan has been built. As surely as there is no mention at this stage of gathering animals for korbanos. Even though they're also important, but that's part of Avodas HaMishkan. But the topic of the beginning of Truma is about Binyan HaMishkan, the Osuli Mikdash, V'Shachanti B'Socham. What then is the oil for the menorah, one of the mitzvahs of the Mishkan, doing mentioned among the list, as part of the list of the items for building the Mishkan? And the answer of the Tosos is a very elegant approach. Tosos say that the definition really of a building is when it's fit for entry, when it's fit for habitation. Now, the Havdil, when is a house considered to be built? Well, as soon as it has walls and a roof and everything else is commentary. That's true for a normal person. But what about a royal palace? Say the Tosfos, even once everything has been built, but it's dark, a king will never enter. It's not Lefi Kvodo. And therefore, turning on the lights, or providing light inside the premises, which would then allow the king to enter, and one cannot dwell without entering, is considered actually for a royal palace, part of the binyan. Now it's fit for entry. Say the Tosfos, the Havdil, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need the light, but it's to represent the Malchus for us. If there's no light in the Mishkan, so it's not fit for the king to enter. And therefore, say Tosfos, Shemen Lama'or, the oil for the light, is actually as much a part of the construction components as the beams and the curtains and the gold and the silver and everything else. Shemen Lama'or. It's a wonderful peirush. Based on the Tosfos, we may consider the following point. It turns out that if indeed providing light is part of the binyan, then there's something about the mitzvah of lighting the menorah that in a sense sets it aside from the other mitzvahs. The other mitzvahs are part of the operation of the Mishkan. But the lighting of the menorah is actually reinstating the Mishkan as fully built. If you need light for the king to enter and then it's considered to be built, essentially Aaron, on a daily basis, is completing the construction of the Mishkan by lighting the Ner. And with this in mind, perhaps we can understand why it was that it was with the mitzvah of menorah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu comforted Aaron. Aaron, he's involved in the Avodah, but he feels he missed out on the Chanukah, on getting things going, on the initiation. Based on our discussion through the Tosos, we understand that the mitzvah of the menorah has another aspect to it. It represents the completion of the Mishkan. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Aaron, through lighting the menorah, you will be involved in the Chanukas HaMishkan every day. And that is Shalcha Gedola Mishelahem. So having discussed for a few moments the opening of Balo Secha, I'd like to move to one of the very difficult sections of the Parsha, difficult in terms of Parshanot, and also emotionally. It's a low point really for us, Bnei Yisrael, and that's Kivros HaTava. And let's take a look at Perek Yud Aleph, which is really where things begin to go wrong. Pasuk Dalet. V'hasafsuf asher bikirbo. That's not a common word for us. The v'hasafsuf, those that were Lashon Asifa, gathered in. We'll find exactly who they are in just a moment. But these people, asafsuf asher bikirbo, hisavu tava, they desired a desire. V'yashuvu v'yivku gam b'nei Yisrael. Soon enough, the Jewish people themselves, b'nei Yisrael proper, we're also crying over this. Who are the Asafsuf? Rashi says, Elu Erev Rav. This is a reference to the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude that came out with us from Mitzrayim. She ne'espu aleihem. They were gathered in towards Bnei Yisrael. B'teisam in Mitzrayim. We never know a lot of nachas from the Erev Rav. But Moshe never let them go. He carries them. But they cause trouble. They lead trouble for Bnei Yisrael. What begins with the Asafsuf crying becomes quite soon the Bnei Yisrael themselves. Mi yachilenu basar. What are they crying over? Well, the Pasuk says explicitly, Mi yachilenu basar. Okay, we didn't realize that meat was that important, but now we know. Later on, in Pasuk Yud, we will find that there is apparently more to the situation than just meat. In Pasuk Yud, Vayishma Moshe es ha'am boche lemishpachosav. Moshe hears the people crying lemishpachosav in their families. Ish lepesach ha'alo, each person by the entrance of his tent. Vayichaf Hashem odu ve'enei Moshe ra. Hashem is angry. Moshe thinks it's terrible. It is terrible. What is the meaning of the words boche l'mishpachosav? Crying in their families. To their families. Rashi gives two perushim. One of their hapshat and the other based on the Gemara. We'll see how they go. Firstly, says Rashi, boche l'mishpachosav, crying in their families. We must translate it in as straight a line as possible. Mishpachos, mishpachos, ne'esofim ubochim. Families got together. It's a bit of an ironic use of the word ne'esofim that began with the asafsuf, who were ne'esofim, and sure enough, there's a different type of ne'esofim that happens. They gather together to cry, lefarsim tarumosim begoloi, in order to publicize their discontent. So Bochel Mishpachosam, according to the Pshat, is a reference to the form, the manner in which they cried. They didn't cry in a disorganized manner, but rather they grouped together as families, which is a terrible spectacle, the family that cries together. And it's such an extreme gesture to organize themselves in that way. It's persume milsa. Just that everyone should know. But then, Rashi brings another perush, and this is based on the Gemara in Maseches Yuma at the beginning of the 8th perek. V'rabo seinu amru, l'mishpachosav, the lamed of the word l'mishpachosav, not to their families, about grouping, it's about their families. Al iske mishpachos. It was because of family matters. Al arayos hane esoros lahem. All the relationships that had become forbidden to them. With the giving of the Torah, although before Matan Torah, the circle of what was considered arayos, forbidden family relationships, was very small. It broadened with the giving of the Torah. If we consult the end of Parshas Acharemos and then the Parshas Kedoshim, It's a broader group. And this is what they were crying about. Very different. Rabbi Seinu Amru, the second explanation. Mishpachosav becomes the matter not just the form. They're crying over all of these relationships. But certainly in the earlier times, the more natural choice for marriage was very much within the family. And those are all barred from there. Parenthetically, we should note, this comment of the Gemara, which is quoted by Rashi, would seem to be a support for the position of the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh in Parshas Vayigash, who states that although, as we know, the Jewish people underwent Geirus, and there are halachas of Geirus that we learned from Ma'amad Har Sinai, which means it was a full bona fide transition from non-Yisrael, pre-Yisrael, to Yisrael. Nonetheless, there is one aspect of Geirus that did not accrue to them, and that is the well-known concept that Ger Shenis Gair Kekoton Shenola Dami. When someone converts to Judaism, he is considered to be reborn. At that point, he has no family connections to those that were originally part of his family. That's not only true if he's the only one of the family to convert. Even if the entire family converts, they're no longer halakhically considered to be related to each other. Ger Shenis Gair Kekoton Shenola Dami. Not surprisingly, the rabbis imposed upon them all of the restrictions. They shouldn't convert in order to make things more mutter than it was before they were Jewish. But as far as strict in Torah is concerned, and there are other ramifications, it's kekoton shenolad. They're born anew. The Maharal states, however, this aspect did not apply to the Jewish people. They retained all of their family relationships and connections. And he explains why, and there's explanations with regards to his explanation. But for our purposes, we see, it seems, that his position is corroborated by the Gemara here, quoted by Rashi, because they were bochel l'mishpachosam. They were very upset. All these relationships were now barred to them. If they were kekot and shenola, then nothing's barred to anyone. It's all hakol yumutarin lach. Even more is mutter than before Matan Torah. Rather, they retain their family relationships. That's the support for the Maharal. We should note, there is a Meshech Chachma in Parshat Eschanan, which indicates that the concept of being born anew applied even to that generation who received the Torah. He would need to reckon with this Gemara, which they were so upset about all these new relationships that were forbidden to them, family relationships. How exactly he would do that is a matter for a discussion at a different time. But for our purposes, it has been revealed to us that they're not just crying over meat, mi yachileinu basar, but there is also this aspect of they can't just marry whoever they like. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky asked a simple shaila. We see a certain remez in the Torah, lemishpachosav, and it needs treatment. And Gemara sees in this that they're crying over all of these new relationships. Remez can do many things, but it can't compete with the pshat. As if to say, if we're wondering, well, what do we think they're really crying over? One doesn't need to detect it. It's enough to read it, because the pasuk earlier said explicitly, mi yachileinu basar. Which means once you have, black on white, what it is that they're complaining about, there doesn't seem to be room to search further to try and find out what they'd be complaining about. And yet the Gemara does. And we should want to know why. Rabbi Yaakov explains, and it's a Yesod Godel. As far as the Gemara is concerned, it is clear that there is more to what is going on here than mi yachileinu basar. It has to be. You look at how Bnei Yisrael are complaining. Let us see Pasuk Hey straight after mi yachileinu basar. Zacharnu es hadaga, asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish that we would eat. It's a kind of a glorification backwards of how good life was in Mitzrayim. Es hakishuim, es avatichim, es hachatzir, es habetzalim, es hashumim. Five types of vegetables that apparently they're missing. The onions and the garlic and the melons. And this pasuk is very troubling. The Jewish people, a self-respecting group, are crying because there's no onions or garlic, and they just collapse. So Rabbi Yaakov says, a lack of onions and garlic, it's not a cause for national mourning. I mean, there has to be some type of perspective here. So once the pasuk, a pasuk in the Torah, has turned into essentially a grocery list, which is more and more agonizing as each item is added on until you've got five things and that's it. That's why life is so miserable. They've got the man. It can taste like anything you want. And for some reason, maybe it doesn't taste like these five things. And there's just no way they can continue forward. Says Rabbi Yaakov, when grown adults start crying over things like this, something else is happening. There's no question about it. It comes out over this. But that's very interesting. Sometimes it works. It happens that way. That the real issue is not so much identified, and a lot of the latent emotion that relates to that issue gets diverted to something else entirely, which doesn't warrant it at all. Marshall, if someone is having a terrible day at work, and the bigger company is eating up the smaller company, and revenue is losing, and it's just one disaster after another, and he battles his way through the day, he comes home and his key doesn't fit in the door. So at a time like that, it's possible for a person just to collapse. If his neighbor would see him, he'd feel the poor guy is overreacting. Okay, your key doesn't fit in the door. Try again. Well, why? You're a grown person. Why are you reacting so terribly over such a small thing? It's not over that thing. It just came out over that thing. It's been either repressed over the course of the day, and this, finally it found an outlet. It's very interesting because that means that the more minor the items, the more mundane the Jewish people mention, the more convinced we are that this, it's not about this at all. And what's interesting is to note, it's possible that the Jewish people themselves are not aware of just how much they're bothered by the Arias issue. We don't know. When they say that they're bothered by the onions and the garlic that are missing, it could be they really think that. Sometimes when something is buried deep, the person himself really does believe that he's upset over this other thing. He can't relate to the fact that what it is that he's really upset about. And that's really part of the avodas ha'emes, for a person to know what really motivates them. The way that they're reacting, what is it about? I'm reminded, so to speak, of the Baalei HaMusar, the Alter Slabodka of Nosson Tzvi Finkel once had occasion to travel to St. Petersburg, which is very far from, all the way in the north there in Russia, very far from Slabodka. He needed medical treatment, which could only be provided there. So he went through the treatment, and it was successful, and he's there for another day or two, and while he's there, he meets a Talmud of his, an ex-student of Slabodka. So the Talmud, of course, delighted to see the Rebbe. Who would have thought he'd meet him in St. Petersburg? And so he asks, Shalom Aleichem, what brings the Rebbe to St. Petersburg? So the Alter said, I'll tell you, do you know, have you ever seen those umbrellas where there's a spring inside, which means when you want to open it, you actually push up the umbrella, you can press the button and it opens by itself. Did you ever see something like that? So the student says, yes, I have. So the Alter said, that's what brings you to St. Petersburg. The student, poor thing, had no idea what was going on. And the Alter explained, said, officially, I'm here for medical treatment. It's not the condition that I have, it can't be just treated anywhere. We did our investigations, and we concluded that St. Petersburg is the best place. And you've got to go to the best place, so even though it's far away. And so I did, and Baruch Hashem was successful. But now that it's finished, I'm thinking back. And I realize that something else is going on. You see, the truth is that there was a place much closer to Slabodka, to Kovno, where I could have had the treatment. And I now recognize that the level of treatment was really the same. But Becholzot, I went for St. Petersburg. Why? So the Alter said, I was here 10 years ago for a meeting of Rabbanim. And while I was passing through St. Petersburg, there was a fair. I mean, it was an industrial center, and they were exhibiting all of the latest inventions. And something that caught my attention was this umbrella. where for the first time you didn't have to open the umbrella yourself, it had a spring and you could press the button and the thing opened. I was very impressed at the time. And now I realize that when I was making my decision as to where the best treatment, and I concluded that it's going to be here, really what I was thinking at the back of my mind is, I wonder what else they've discovered in St. Petersburg in the last 10 years. So this is from one of the greats, to be able to unravel through the labyrinth of what it is that we think, what we think that we think, and sometimes we don't realize what it is that we're really thinking after all. In any event, it remains an open question. Rabbi Yaakov himself doesn't go into it as to whether Bnei Yisrael were aware on some level that it's really about Arias. Maybe they weren't, but one thing's for sure. It is very appropriate that this matter of crying over family relationships is buried in Remez, L'mishpachosa. For as we have seen so many times, that is the difference between Pshat, then Drash, and certainly then Remez. What's apparent to the Pasuk when you read it is apparent in the situation if you would have read it. And what you need to detect in the Pasuk is what you would have needed to detect in the situation. That's the correspondence. And therefore, what's black and white in the Pasuk are all the vegetables. Because that's what they're expressly talking about. What's buried in Remez was buried in them. Iske mishpachosa. That's what brought about such a violent reaction. Now we should know, with regard to this matter of Bochim and Mishpachosa, all of these forbidden relationships, the Mizrahi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, the preeminent commentator on Rashi, raises a simple question. Why are Bnei Yisrael only crying about these relationships now? And the background to the question is, we know, I mean, their traveling from Har Sinai has been marked by the Torah, dated the 20th of Iyar, which is almost a full year after they received the Torah. 6th of Sivan, or 7th of Sivan. And from the time that Moshe came down on the Machras Yom HaKippurim, it's more than 6 months, 7 months in fact, which means surely to wait 7 months from when you've received the Torah and all of a sudden there's this national outburst, that's a very highly developed, delayed, synchronized reaction. So why is it that they didn't react this way until 7 months after Moshe begins to teach them? And based on this, the Mizrahi presents a yesod. And we'll see how the different Mefarshim react to it. But the yesod is, we say that the entire Torah is given to Moshe at Sinai. Okay, Moshe kibol Torah mi Sinai. Klalim, klalim upratim. But then it was given over to Bnei Yisrael. The transmission of the Torah from Moshe to Bnei Yisrael happened in stages. And it could take time. And they didn't hear everything at once. And it could take months. And 7 months in, they got to the issue of Arayos. And that, therefore, it's not a delayed reaction. This is the time that Bnei Yisrael are hearing about it, and they react badly to it. Says the Mizrahi, I'll prove to you what I'm saying. It seems a radical notion that certain sections of the Torah were not given straight away when Moshe came down from Har Sinai. Well, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Gittin, Daf Samach, Amud Aleph, famous statement of the Gemara, Shmona Parsios Nemu Bo Bayom. The reference is to Bo Bayom is the first of Nisan, the day of the setting up of the Mishkan. And the Gemara tells us that there were 8 areas of Torah that were set at that time. Whatever they may be, the Parsha of Paraduma, and the Parsha of Tuma, and the Parsha of Avoda, and whatever it may be. Now, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, once again, is almost a full 6 months after Yom Kippur. But apparently, these were 8 major sections of the Torah that had not yet been transmitted. That's an example of what I'm talking about, says the Mizrahi, that it was given over time. It was given over stages. Some things took 6 months to come out. Some things took 7 months to come out, like Bochel and Mishpachosam. Those are his words. Now, someone who took exception to this approach, or more correctly, this application of the Mizrahi, was the Nachlas Yaakov. The Nachlas Yaakov is one of the great later Mefarshei Rashi, Rabbi Yaakov Selnik. And often, actually, he takes the Mizrahi to task, which made him very unpopular, actually, in certain circles, because he dared to take on the Mizrahi, but he did. And here, again, relating to the Mizrahi, his point is some parshas came out later on. Case in point, the eight parshas of Rosh Chodesh Nissan. If it's true for that, it can be true for this, says the Nachlas Yaakov. How can you compare the two? When the Gemara says in Gittin that there were eight parshas that were said on that day, that I can understand, because those were areas of the Torah which weren't relevant before that day. When do you need the Parah Adumah if you want to enter the Mishkan? When do you need to know about the Dinei Tumah and Tara if you're going to go into the Mishkan? When do you need the halachas of Korbanos and all for the Mishkan? So they were mentioned later as per relevant. But how can you compare that to our discussion of the forbidden family relationships? They're forbidden instantly. That's not relevant in 6 months' time or 7 months' time. It's relevant today. What were they talking about if they weren't talking about this? That's 6 months of violations of Torah prohibitions. That is the kasha of the Nachlas Yaakov. It's a good kasha. I wonder if perhaps contained within the words of the Mizrahi, but this is a very interesting question, when did the prohibitions of the Torah become binding on Bnei Yisrael? With the giving of the Torah or with the deliverance of those sections of the Torah to Bnei Yisrael? If it's true that you can't say everything at once, let's assume they didn't cover everything in one day. So what they found out on day two, that on day one they didn't know, that means that they had inadvertently or unknowingly violated a Torah prohibition. They just didn't have enough time to find out about it, perhaps. Or could it be that the initiation of each area of Torah as a prohibition binding or an obligation binding on the Jewish people corresponds to the time that it was given to them? Which means there is no issue of they're living in sin or violating a prohibition unknowingly. If they don't know about it, it's not a prohibition for them. The only question would be, why would it be the case that these prohibitions were not initiated until 7 months into Matan Torah? But that's it for us as an imponderable. We don't know why Hashem chose, so to speak, to certain times to tell them about those certain things. So this is a major discussion about the transmission of the Torah and the point of initiation of the various obligations and prohibitions on Bnei Yisrael. We should note, just to support the Mizrahi, he seems to be supported by the Rambam, and the Rambam himself is sourced in the Sifrei. For when the Rambam talks about Bochen and Mishpachosam, which he does, because the Rambam is offering chizuk and empathy in the area of Arayos, so the Rambam says it's not easy. The Jewish people have had a hard time with it, and Amru Rabbeinu Bishah Shenitzdavu al Arayos, at the time that they were commanded concerning Arayos, Hayu Bochim, they were crying. That's a reference, of course, to our Gemara. But what the Rambam does is he actually timestamps it and tells us that that this was their reaction at the time that they were told about it. That support for the Mizrahi, the time they cried was the time that they heard, 7 months in, so be it. So this is the approach of the Mizrahi. I'd like to present quite a different approach from someone much later, contemporary actually, Talmud Chacham of our time, the Sefer Shiras David, Rav Aaron David Goldberg. And he also, in his way, reveals an important yesod, much to think about. He draws our attention, of course, to the famous section that's bracketed in Parshas Baalo Secha, Vayihi ben Sar Ha'aron Uvenucho Yomar, which is at the beginning of, or more correctly, the end of Perek Yud, the final two Psukim of Perek Yud. Okay. Why are those psukim bracketed? Well, the Gemara discusses this in Masechah Shabbos in Daf Kuftes Zayin, and the Gemara says that these two psukim are wedged in between two peronios. Rashi quotes it in the Parsha, two calamities. L'hafzik bin peronios, the peronios, in order to make a break. can't have two Puranas together. Okay. Which of the two calamities that these psukim are coming to divide between? Rashi, actually in the Pasuk doesn't comment, but on the Gemara Shabbos there, Rashi says, it's to divide between the misonanim, which actually is dealt with very quickly. It's like three psukim, vayiyam ki misonanim, and they were taken care of very swiftly. The Kivras HaTaba takes the rest of the chapter. To divide between Kivras HaTava and the Misonanim. Hisavu Tava and the Misonanim. Tava is the desire, Misonanim are the complaints. Two separate sections, or two distinct incidents. They're put together, the Torah wedges them apart. The only problem is, and this Tosfos raises, it's too simple a question. If you look at these psukim, they don't feature between the Misonanim and Kivras HaTava. We just mentioned the references. The first three psukim of Perek Yud Aleph are Misonanim. Immediately afterwards, beginning with Pasuk Dalet, is Kivras HaTava. So these are two psukim that are meant to prize these two events apart, but they don't. And they're before both of them. Just a major question. And Mefarshei Rashi explain that what Rashi means to say is that what do we have before these two psukim at the end of Perek Yud? We have the famous Pasuk Lamed Gimel Vayis'u Mehar Hashem. They traveled from the mountain of Hashem. Then you have these two psukim interrupting, and then you have Misonanim. Rashi says the two psukim interrupt between Tava and Misonanim. Apparently what Rashi is telling us is that although it took a while to come out, the beginnings of this bad desire were already with them when they left Har Sinai. And essentially, the Pasuk is looking to wed apart the root of Kivras HaTava, which began at the end of Perek Yud, by Yusuf Mehar Hashem. Everything that happens for the balance of Perek Yud Aleph is emanations. But the root of the problem is at the end of Perek Yud, and that's prized apart from Misonanim. In fact, support for this, if we look at Pasuk Dalet, it says, V'ha'asafsuf asher b'kirbo, his-avutava. His-avutava. It's rare, as the Torah describes things, that we find the word his-avu in the past without the vav. It's normally the vav that takes the future to the past. Vayomer and Vayidaber. It should be Vayis'avu. It doesn't say Vayis'avu. As Rashi has told us in Parshas Bereishis, the difference between using the Vav for the past, or just a straight past, is the difference between what's called an ongoing past, and then this happened, or a past perfect. This had already happened. The pure use of the past is something that didn't happen then. It had already happened. And that's really what Rashi is saying. Vasafsuf asher b'kirbo his'avu. Tava. They had already begun to develop this desire. It didn't come out until now. The question is, how are the beginnings of this Tava rooted in Vayisu Mehar Hashem? And Vayisu Mehar Hashem is geography. They traveled from one place to another. And how is that meant to contain the beginnings of Kivras HaTava? And the Shiras David explains something very simple and wonderful idea. It could be that as long as the Jewish people were at Har Sinai, the atmosphere, the setting of being around Har Sinai elevated them, or protected them. There was a certain sense that they should be at their best at Har Sinai, which means they were able to meet the restrictions of the Torah, perhaps with equanimity and much more understanding. That was what it was like to be at Har Sinai, just to be there. It made a difference. They say, in fact, the Mefarshei Haggadah, we say in Dayenu, we go through 15 things, and if we did this, Dayenu, this, Dayenu, some of them were at least distinct stages, but one of the puzzling ones is where it says, Ilu kervanu lefnei Har Sinai velo nasalanu es HaTorah. Had Hashem brought us to Har Sinai and not given us the Torah, oh, Dayenu would have been wonderful. Ask the Abu Dharam, it would have been a waste of time. I mean, what are we there for if not to receive the Torah? It's not like something's happened yet. It would have been a wasted journey. Rather, says the Abu Dara, no. There was great benefit just at Har Sinai, even before receiving the Torah, to be in the presence of the Shekhinah. Har Sinai, the best place to be. It's a distinct benefit, in addition to then receiving the Torah. So, here comes the difficult stage, whereby the Jewish people are not meant to live indefinitely around Har Sinai. They're going to move on. They have to move on. The critical question will be, well, how do they move on? Meaning, what now defines the transition as they move from Har Sinai? Do they move from Har Sinai and leave all of that Har Sinai-ness behind? Or try somehow to bring it with them? To retain their standards that they had at Har Sinai? In a sense, to absorb the atmosphere, which means they can take it with them. In a sense, therefore, the roots of Kivrus HaTava are contained within the words Vayisu Mi Har Hashem. They traveled from Har Hashem means they left it behind. They left it behind, it means things that they were okay with when they were at Har Sinai, they stopped being okay with because they're not at Har Sinai anymore and that atmosphere isn't here anymore, which means things that didn't bother them begin to bother them. That's why the words Vayibin Soha'or in that parsha is coming to address the root of the problem. Vayisu Mi Har Hashem is the beginning of the problem of the Tava. Says Shiras David, with this approach, we can understand or respond to the question of the Mizrahi. Mizrahi asked the question, why are they only crying now? Did they not receive these mitzvahs so many months ago? The Mizrahi's approach was, maybe they only receive them now. Says the Shiras David, it could be that they very well did receive them so long ago, but it didn't bother them until now. But having left Mitzrayim, pardon me, having left Har Sinai, they look at things differently now. And in fact, says Shiras David, perhaps we can find corroboration for this idea. They began to complain about the man. And it's always worrying when the Jewish people complain about the man. Pasuk Vav, Atana Yashenu Yevesha Ein Kol. Where all we have is man. What's the problem with the man? The Medrash tells us that Bnei Yisrael voiced a concern about the man, because it was in the nature of man that there was no waste product, which means all it was ingested, but nothing ever left the person. And Bnei Yisrael are voicing this worry that they'll explode. I mean, how long can this go on for? So it's dangerous. It's bad for the Jews. That's their worry. So, says Shiras David, let's ask a simple question. I mean, if it's within the first 3 days of eating the man, so who knows what's going to happen? But they've been eating man for over a year now. They've been okay. So they're okay. So why are they worried? It could be that it was a non-argument, a non-complaint, just something to complain about, even though it wasn't real. But it could be something else. It's possible that Bnei Yisrael themselves intuited that they'd fallen somewhat from the way they were at Har Sinai. In which case, they can't use their past experience, positive experience with the man, as any reassurance for now. At Har Sinai, the man, it's what's called Nivla Be'ivarim, right? It gets absorbed fully within the system. But at Har Sinai, because it's a spiritual food, at Har Sinai they were spiritual people. So they were reconciled and okay, at ease with the fact that there was no waste. But now they realize that they'd fallen, they'd become that much more physical. If they've become physical and still eat the man, now they're not sure what's going to happen. There arose this concern that if there's no waste coming out, who knows what's going to happen. So this is a somewhat different approach to the issue of Kivrus HaTava alongside that of the Mizrahi. And the truth is, as we are seeing, there's different layers really to what's bothering Bnei Yisrael. And the furthest or the deepest layer has not yet even been expressed. That becomes expressed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. In Pasuk Yud Ches, of Perek Yud Aleph, Ve'al Ha'am Tomar, Hiskatshu L'machar, Bechaltem Basar, prepare yourselves and you will eat meat, Ki V'chisim Basnei Hashem, Ne'mor Mi'yechi L'nu Basar. You said, who's going to feed us meat? Ki Tov Lanu B'Mitzrayim, be better for us in Mitzrayim. And in the end of Pasuk Kaf, V'tivku L'fanav Le'mor Lama Ze'yatzanu Mitzrayim, why did we ever leave Mitzrayim? Now that's something that was never openly voiced by the Jewish people. They're worried about this, they're worried about that, maybe it's things that they can't eat, maybe it's people that they can't marry. No one ever said, Lama Ze'yatzanu Mitzrayim. But the deepest level, of course, is heard by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. When they say, we remember everything that we used to eat in Mitzrayim, so the truth here is within that, that really what they're saying is, and then maybe we should go back there. It's not just saying, if only whatever we had there we could have here, we'd be fine. We're remembering how things were in Mitzrayim, because that's the part of the Jewish people that wants to go back to Mitzrayim. And in fact, again, it's a slight remez, but in Pasuk Hey, they say, Zacharnu es hadaga. We remember the fish. Asher nochal b'Mitzrayim chinam. Asher nochal. Now the word nochal, in pure terms, is a future tense. Well, it's an imperfect, more correctly. Now, al derech hapshat, asher nochal, it's an ongoing past. Kacha yaseh. Asher nochal means that we would eat. But the remez here is the pure future, which means they're, again, in a way that either they're aware of or not aware of, they're basically talking about what they'd like to do and what they'd like to eat when they go back to Mitzrayim. What will we eat in Mitzrayim? Asher nochal. We remember what it is that we will eat. But it was in Mitzrayim. Yeah, maybe we should go back there. And this was the central indictment of Bnei Yisrael. Ultimately, they're all related, as if to say, their relationship with the mitzvahs of the Torah and new conditions could very well result in reverting to old conditions. And that is a failure which is unacceptable. And the Jewish people are punished for it. Interestingly, it's not the first time the Jewish people even openly said, let's just go back to Mitzrayim. And they were never really punished for it beforehand. They were all through Parshas Beshalach, they're saying, why did you take us here? Let's just go back to Mitzrayim. And nothing bad ever happens to them. And here it's perceived, and they're taken to task for it. So the Mefarshim explain that originally, in Parshas Beshalach, when we're saying the whole time, well, there's not enough graves in Egypt, that's why we're here, why we should have been better to go back there, that wasn't considered a fundamental flaw with the Jewish people. For a simple reason. They did not yet fully realize that everything that Moshe was doing was in full accordance with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had told him to do. That's why the Pasuk says when they saw Mitzrayim approaching, Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem, they cried out to Hashem. They started davening. Next Pasuk says, they complained to Moshe. What, not enough graves? Hamiblin kavurim b'Mitzrayim. Ask the Mefarshim, one pasuk ago, you were at your frumest and you're davening, and now you're complaining against Moshe. Decide. But they didn't see a contradiction between these two things. As far as they were concerned, maybe Hashem was happy for them to go back to Mitzrayim after 3 days, and maybe it's Moshe that wants them to keep going. So they were actually on a certain level davening to Hashem to save them from Moshe's plans for them. They didn't yet have a full cognition of the fact that what Moshe is doing is from Hashem. Until the stunning miracle of Kriyas Yamsuv, which began to change things for them. The development was by Aminu Bashem Uva Moshe Avdo. That was a new chiddush. And it was finalized at Har Sinai. As the Rambam says in the famous Hilchos Yesodia Torah, the absolute trust that we have in Moshe Rabbeinu is based on the fact that we heard at Har Sinai HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to Moshe as his emissary towards us. Once that's true, so then there's no longer a discrepancy in their minds between what Moshe wants for them and what Hashem wants for them. Moshe is Eved Ne'eman. which means if they still don't want to go back to Mitzrayim, that means that they're not happy with Hashem's plans for them. That's a different order of complaint altogether, and they are indeed taken to task for it. So these are some aspects of the section of Kivras Hatav. There's plenty more to talk about. I'd like to conclude by referring to the final section of the Parsha, which is Miriam and Aaron talking about Moshe. They feel that he's not behaving really correctly in terms of him and his wife. He's separated from his wife for purposes of Nevuah. As far as they were concerned, their Nevuah was on an equal level to his, and they didn't separate from their spouses. Until they are corrected in this regard by Hashem, who tells them that Moshe is very different than them, and that was that's why what everything he has done has been appropriate and correct. The way that Hashem's words are introduced in Pasuk Vav of Perek Yud Beis, the first few psukim are them talking. Pasuk Vav, Vayomer Shimu Na Devarai. Hashem says, "Hear now, please, my words." And goes on to talk about what a normal Navi, quote-unquote, normal Navi, standard Navi is, as opposed to Moshe Rabbein. There's a very interesting comment of the word, on the phrase, Shimu Na Devarai. It's a very formal introduction, or preamble, to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is about to say. Normally, when Hashem says something, he says it. Here, he begins with the words Shimu Na Devarai. And Chazal were alerted to this. And there are actually two explanations in the Sifrei. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Shimu Na Devarai. What's the meaning of these words Shimu Na? So, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai explains the reason why Hashem said, "Hear," is Elash, hear me now. Because Miriam and Aaron were looking to interrupt or to get there first and explain themselves to Hashem. So Amar lehem hamakom, so Hashem said, Hamtinuli ad she'edrosh, wait until I finished. Shimuna dvarai means hear me first, then you can talk. According to Rishim Ben Yochai, these words are actually either preempting or responding to, they're looking to justify themselves as quickly as possible. And they had their justifications. Amazingly, they were prepared to do that even when Hashem was about to talk to them. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Shimu no deparai. First, I'm speaking, you should wait for me, and then you can speak. According to this explanation of or interpretation of Rishim Ben Yochai, the word na means now, as if to say, Shimu na devarai, wait for me, I will speak now, and you will speak later on. But there's another interpretation in the Sifrei, which moves the word na to a different understanding. The primary translation of the word na is now, ka'an, as Unklus translates. But na, Rashi in a number of places says, e na el aloshan bakasha. It's an expression of request. And therefore, Hashem is prefacing by saying, Shimu na devarai, please listen to me. That's interesting. Why should he have to request that they listen to him? Says the Sifrei, V'hari dvarim kal v'chomer. And now there's a kal v'chomer here. U'ma im misha oma v'haya olam dibir b'tachanunim. If Hashem has spoken in a way of appeasement to them, he's their creator, but he requests of them and is nice to them, because he's about to criticize them. He's about to rebuke them. And he doesn't do so in a harsh way. Shimu na devarai. He puts them at ease. Kavachomer lebasav adam. So according to this perush of the Sifrei, Shimu na devarai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was about to administer tochecha to them. And the way to do that is to begin in a friendly tone. And the Sifrei says, if Hashem can do it, so can you. And that's the klal gadol of tochecha. It has to be done in a way that demonstrates goodwill. Otherwise, it's not really tochecha at all. I came across a wonderful statement of the Nesivah Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe, in Parshas Shmini, one of the famous rebukes of the Torah. As Moshe rebuked Aaron, in mistake it turned out, where there were certain korbanos that they burnt, and he felt that they shouldn't have burnt them. It's a whole parsha there. He says, "Madua lo achaltem es habasar b'mkom hakodesh? Why didn't you consume the basar of the korbanos? Why did you burn them?" And they explained themselves, but that was his rebuke. Why? So the Nesiva Shalom says, if you look at the words, and this is a Madua lo achaltem es habasar b'mkom hakodesh? Why did you not consume the meat in the holy place? Look at those words, and look at the Rashi Tevis of those words, and you will find the following. Of those eight words, the Rashi Tevis are Mem, Lamed, Aleph, Aleph, He, Beis, He. Seven words. Spell the two words Male, Ahava. That's how you do it. If you're criticizing, Madu al Achaltem, but the tone should be set Male, Ahava. So that's the second explanation of the Sifrei. Just to conclude with an altogether different approach, it's to be found in the commentary of the Hafla, Rav Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, in Maseches Ksubas, in Daf Hey. And it's quite stunning. Shimuna Devarai. The Hafla, again, our question is, why does Hashem need to introduce his words with these words? Are they not going to listen? Says the Hafla, no, maybe they weren't going to listen. Maybe they couldn't listen. He quotes the Sefer Olulus Ephraim. Olulus Ephraim is the Sefer of Drushas by the Kliokar. We're familiar with the Kliokar's Pirush on the Torah, Rav Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz. He also has two volumes of Drushas, Olulus Ephraim, which are classic work. And there, the Kliokar says that one of the negative results of hearing Dvarim Asurim, of hearing Lashon Hara, is that it impairs a person's sensitivity to hear good things. That's very interesting. When a person is exposed to hearing Lashon Hara, it renders it all the more harder for them, on whatever level it is, maybe more than one level, to hear good things. Well, there's nothing better, says the Hafla, there's no better things to hear than the words of Hashem. Aaron and Miriam could not hear it, because they just heard Lashon Hara. And therefore that rendered them incapable of hearing Devar Hashem. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu reinstalled their capacity to hear with the words Shimu na Devarai. He re-empowered them to hear what it is that he had to say. So that is a fascinating approach to Shimu na Devarai. He is reclaiming for them, restoring for them the faculty of hearing that was impaired on their level through Lashon Hara. And the moral of the story obviously will be, as we always, when we come to this section of Miriam, no one will ever have a milder case of Lashon Hara or more of an excuse for saying what they said than Miriam. And it didn't help her. And that the Rambam says, if it didn't help Miriam, we're unlikely to be in a better position than she is. And that's the lesson to be learned. And it's important to learn this lesson from Miriam. If you don't learn the lesson from Miriam, I sometimes wonder whether it's permissible to even talk about this episode with Miriam, if it's not for purposes of learning something for ourselves. Otherwise, it's just talking about Miriam. That could itself be Lashon Hara. That's an open question by me. But in any case, plenty to learn from the beginning of the Parsha, Hanukkah Samishkan, from Kibrus Atava, culminating, and of course plenty in the middle that we missed out, which I have to fill in Mitzvah Hashem. But Od Moed, we'll leave it over there for this evening.